This is the Poetry Magazine podcast for May 2012. I'm Christian Wyman, editor of Poetry Magazine.
And I'm Don Scherer, senior editor of the magazine. On the Poetry Magazine podcast, we feature readings from poets in the current issue.
This month, we're going to hear poems from Kimiko Han.
People can read anything into dreams, and I do as well.
Devin Johnston.
I have in mind one April morning when she relented without warning.
Then we're going to hear an unusual take on Marianne Moore by Maureen McLean.
It's an experience of passionate thinking and difficult thinking.
Here's some of the other things in the May issue. For prose, we have the last in our series of notebooks from Anna Kamienska, which is translated from The Polish by Claire Kavanaugh. We've got new poems by Ray Armantrout, Franz Wright, Maria Hummel, and many others. Don, was there somewhere you wanted to start, something you particularly liked this month?
Yes, I like this poem by Adam Vines. This is first appearance in the magazine, called River Politics. It's one of those poems that's just fun to read, and it goes like this. River Politics. I spit my smack. Jim slugs his jack. Rob stews his lack. Carrie prepares his rack. Herons hunker on blowdowns. Deer wait on high moon for their rounds. And the campfire might as well be an empire. We all watch dissolve in the slough, a carp roll, a splash into ash.
It's nice to come across a poem like this that's just sort of well, I mean, it's not exactly straightforward. There are all kinds of metaphors,
right.
but it's straightforward in a way, and it makes this wonderful, playful music that bounces you through the poem.
I like, too, that it's got a sort of regionalism going for it, too. You know, I met Adam briefly last summer. He's down in Alabama, and he's a fisherman, if you couldn't tell.
Yeah.
And I can just picture, this is the politics on the river, boy. I can just really picture these guys.
The empire we watched dissolve. all of them lamenting the state of the empire.
Exactly. What's funny about it is you can imagine these guys going on and on just as the day wears on and the bugs fly around and the drinking starts happening. But he really pairs this back into just the most astute, taut lines.
And he creates characters with these quick gestures. You know, I spit my smack, Jim slugs his jack, Rob stews his lack, Harry prepares his... They've all got their designated roles and characters there, and he does it very deftly in just a few lines.
Yeah.
There's a poem, actually, that makes a nice pairing with this by Judith Hall. It's called Just Now Between Positions. These, his last employers... Dead inexplicably and unavailable to praise his diligence, cast a shadow on his prospects, and he sighed. Before all this, he would have lit a pipe and mused on the past in aromatic mauve tobacco. Shadows baffled pleasantly the better rug, once a bear. Grizzly bear. He would have enjoyed a smoke with a bear. Hibernation is not unlike a job you fail to love. He would have enjoyed some banter on and amiable disputation of his claim, or on job loss in general, on night air, the fanfare above a curve, a star, if suitably a sparkle in public. And the reason I think this makes a nice contrast with that is because here's a whole different character, and yet equally well-realized. And you can sort of see this guy putting on his suit even though he's not going to work and lamenting having his own biles and complaints.
Yeah, and it does line up with that other poem. You know, he would have enjoyed a smoke with a bear.
Right.
These are some pretty manly guys, I guess.
Hibernation is not unlike a job you fail to love.
Yeah.
It's funny. It's difficult to create tone in a poem that will call to life a character very quickly. Eliot was actually good at it in Proof Rock, but it's rare. And this poem does it by moving the syntax around in unexpected ways. You know, these his last employers, dead inexplicably and unavailable to praise his diligence, cast a shadow on his prospects, and he sighed.
Yeah.
It's like Henry James has been fired from a job. Right?
That's right. It's funny because the extremity and anxiety that's involved in being just now between positions is not something that you would necessarily associate with this kind of syntax. But the sort of dread and ambivalence here is very real. It's just you don't expect it.
Yeah, it's true. Very much a poem for our times.
Yeah.
Both of them are.
Yeah.
This is the first appearance of Kimiko Han in poetry. She teaches at Queens College in New York, and her latest book of poems is called Toxic Flora.
We have three of her poems in the May issue, and the two that we're going to play for you are both about dreams.
Both dream poems were triggered and inspired by an article from the science section of the New York Times on dream theory, written by Benedict Carey. And to further frustrate myself and inspire myself at the same time, I guess, I kind of made up a form.
The new form required the poems to be under 20 lines, to use a quotation or reference to the article itself, to have a repeating phrase or word.
And also have kind of a list format. So both dream poems were written under that kind of pressure, which was really fun.
Two things that might be helpful to know before we hear the first poem. A netsuke is a carved figurine made out of ivory, bone, or wood that was once used on belts and is now collectible as an art object. And Bunraku is the classic Japanese puppet theater.
Here's Kimiko Han reading The Dream of a Lacquer Box.
I wish I knew the contents, and I wish the contents Japanese, like hairpins made of tortoise shell or bone, though my braid was lopped off long ago, like an overpowering pine incense or a talisman from a Kyoto shrine, like a Hello Kitty diary lock and key, Hello Kitty stickers or candies, a netsuke in the shape of an octopus, ticket stubs from the bunraku, or am I wishing for mother, searching for sister, just hoping to give something Japanese to my daughters? Then again, people can read anything into dreams, and I do as well. I wish I possessed my mother's black lacquer box, though in my dream it was red, though I wish my heart were content.
That's interesting to hear that read aloud, because I had always read that as I wish my heart were content.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you can read it either way. I guess the poet gets to choose when she's reading it aloud. When you just see it on the page, it goes either way.
Yeah.
But it certainly creates a different inflection in the poem if you say content rather than content.
Yeah, it's funny. It really explores those juxtaposed words or meanings of them.
I wish I knew the contents, and I wish the contents Japanese.
We move from content to content, maybe, or I don't know. The ambivalence about it is very striking, and it is a bit like a mystery that's held inside this box that she's envisioning here.
It's a modern dilemma of a person, an immigrant. I don't know if Kimiko Han was an immigrant, but a family probably was, trying to figure out what exactly you're going to pass on to the next generation.
Mm-hmm.
And see, you've got this box, and she wishes the contents were Japanese, but then she compares it to, Hello Kitty diary lock and key, Hello Kitty stickers.
Right, and that's what, if this box gets passed along to a young girl now, those are the things that might go in it, the Hello Kitty stuff, which is authentically Japanese, I guess, possibly just as much as the hairpins made of tortoise shell
right.
and bone. It's just the products of a different part of the culture, a different time in its development and unfolding. But I like that the poem, in setting formal tasks for itself, becomes a very apt way to address these questions. Am I wishing for mother, searching for sister, just hoping to give something Japanese to my daughters? That's very plainly put, but it speaks of a complex and difficult to unfold set of problems that one would have.
Yeah, the form seems to have really concentrated that emotion and the complexity of it. And the poem is spoken very plainly. It has a kind of Japanese feel to it and the austerity of it. That's true of the other one, too. Let's go ahead and hear this second dream poem by Kimiko Han.
Well, for this one, again from the same article on dream theory, I saw the word blood, and I thought of red, and that was the triggering moment for me.
Here's Kimiko Han reading The Dream of a Fire Engine.
Without the sun filtered through closed eyelids, without the siren along the service road, without grandpa's ginger-colored hair, mother's lipstick, daughter's manicure, firecrackers, a monkey's ass, a cherry, Ray's lost elephant, without communist or past tense, or a character seeing her own chopped-off feet dancing in fairy slippers, or Mao's favorite novel about a chamber. The scientist of sleep has claimed that without warm blood, a creature cannot dream.
Well, this is interesting because it purports to be a single dream, you know, the dream of a fire engine, and we do have the one line in the poem, without the siren along the service road, but that's really the only indication that that's what this dream is about.
Yeah.
And in fact, it seems to be a constellation of dream images from all over the place.
Mother's lipstick, daughter's manicure, firecrackers, a monkey's ass, a cherry, Ray's lost elephant.
Ray, that's R-E-I, that's her daughter, Ray's lost elephant. Without communist or past tense, this too makes a puzzle out of a puzzle. I mean, the puzzle of that combined experience across the generations and the way the culture in this family is translating itself out of its history into the present, that would get into your dreams in this way.
And it shows how whole systems of human meaning are constructed biologically. You know, that last line that, you know, without warm blood, a creature cannot dream. But two of the things we've gotten are, you know, without communist or past tense, meaning, you know, here's a system of economics and here's a past tense as part of language. These whole things that we construct, it reduces in the end to warm blood, you know, the biology of it.
I also like how the poem doesn't tell you what to think about these questions.
Yeah, I like that too. Yeah,
it just sets it out there and you have to make sense of it, and maybe you can't.
I once heard W.S. Merwin say in response to a question, he was rebuking someone a little bit, but he was saying, a poem is just the same as a dream. It is what it is. There is no outside that you can step outside of and point to and say this means this. A really effective poem is itself. And this poem functions like a dream in that to step outside and then say this means this, so let me interpret this in a Freudian way or something is to defeat the purpose of it.
Yeah. Both of these poems, all three in the issue, they're very strong, it seems to me, very powerful and strong, but delicate too.
Yeah. Devin Johnston lives in St. Louis and is an editor for Flood Editions. He's been in the magazine before, and this month we have two of his poems leading off the issue.
We're going to hear the first one called New Song.
This is a spring poem, and it's based loosely on an early troubadour lyric.
That troubadour was the troubadour, William IX, Duke of Aquitaine, a favorite of Ezra Pound's. We asked Devin why he was drawn to the Duke's poems, in particular the one that begins, and you'll have to pardon my Provençal, Ab la douceur del temps nouvel.
I really liked how it already felt like they were dealing, these early lyrics are dealing with sort of set conventions that felt old, but they're very playful with them. And it's a spring poem, which appealed to me.
Just before we hear Devin Johnston read this poem, one thing that might help you is the word neumes. He uses the word neumes, which is a sort of prefigured musical note. It's a way of measuring music, but before our standard musical notes that we have now, and it's used in Gregorian chant. Here's Devin Johnston reading New Song.
As sweetness flows through these new days, the woods leaf out, and songbirds phrase in neumes of roosted melody, insipids to a new song. Then love should find lubricity and quicken, having slept so long. The bloodroot blossoms, well and good, but I receive no word that would set my troubled heart at ease, nor could we turn our faces toward the sun and open by degrees, unless we reach a clear accord. And so our love goes, night and day. It's like the thorny hawthorn spray that whips about in a bitter wind from dusk to dawn, shellacked with sleet, until the sun's first rays ascend through leaves and branches, spreading heat. I have in mind one April morning when she relented without warning, relenting from her cold rebuff in laughter, peals of happiness. Sweet Christ, let me live long enough to get my hands beneath her dress. I hate the elevated talk that disregards both root and stalk and sets insipid pride above vicissitudes of lust and strife. Let others claim a higher love. We've got the bread, we've got the knife.
No, this is wonderfully skillfully done, isn't it? It's sort of amazing how he updates this poem and wraps these sentences around the lines and manages to hit the rhyme so unobtrusively.
Well, he really does make a new song out of an old one. He's retained the musicality, but it sounds contemporary.
Yeah, but contemporary with this long echo in it, like Ezra Pound.
I was just going to say, it reminded me of Pound. And it also reminds me a little bit of Tom Picard, who sort of continually writes these border ballads. But it sounds very natural when they do it. That's the key. It doesn't sound like it's an impersonation of anything.
One of the appeals of the poem is that it has this restraint of form, and yet it's about passion, wanting to break loose. You know, sweet Christ, let me live long enough to get my hands beneath her dress.
That's a very Poundian approach.
Yeah.
Very hands-on. But what's really great about it is that the form unwinds. It starts off, you know, you think you're getting a translation of a classic or something. You know, as sweetness flows through these new days, the woods leaf out and songbirds phrase. It sounds almost Chaucerian for a while there.
Right, it sounds very old.
Yeah.
Right.
But then it embodies what it's about. It starts to blossom and get very vivid.
Until the sun's first rays ascend through leaves and branches, spreading heat.
It turns out to be about this growing love that he's got night and day. But then towards the end, where we go with all of this is that he has in mind this one April morning.
When she relented without warning, relenting from her cold rebuff in laughter, peals of happiness.
The poem at this point hives off the cold rebuff, not only the woman's cold rebuff, but the coldness of the season that has led to this kind of, for lack of a better word, fecundity.
And then we get at the end, you know, the bread and the knife, these palpable, solid things that sort of...
And domestic, too, which is very lovely.
Yeah, yeah.
Some of it is just so strikingly epigrammatic.
I hate the elevated talk that disregards both root and stalk.
It doesn't just come out of your head. It really seems to be a kind of... an accumulated understanding of things that you get from poems across long periods of time.
And I didn't know how to take root and stalk there, except unless you were talking about, you know, the root of the language, for one thing. But also then I thought of Herrick's The Vine.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I thought.
Yeah, is it? For those of you who don't remember it from your college English class, Herrick's The Vine is the one where the man wakes up to find that part of his anatomy is more like a stalk than a vine, as he says. And the whole poem works out that metaphor very ingeniously. Maureen McLean is a poet and critic who teaches at New York University. It's the first time that we've had her work in the magazine, and it's an excerpt from her forthcoming book, My Poets.
The book is an experimental blend of criticism and memoir. And in the May issue, we have her essay on Marianne Moore. Here's how it begins.
She has no heirs. She has several epigonies, but their detail-laden lacquered ships, for me, don't float. She flares singular, exemplary, a diamond absolute to the American East forged in a pressure chamber we have yet fully to excavate.
At the center of Maureen McLean's essay is Moore's poem Marriage, which McLean thinks is one of the very best poems of the last century.
For those people who don't know the poem, I mean, there are many ways to talk about it, but one of the things that it stages is a kind of he says, she says dialogue debate between an Adam and a figure and an Eve figure as they're rotating around the question of marriage.
But the poem is little read today, and we asked her why she thought so.
I think that marriage is both not immediately a brand nameable Marianne Moore poem that can tell you something about the Marianne Moore-ishness of Marianne Moore, as she tends to be taught. And it's also, I mean, but this is also true of, I guess, a lot of her poems, it is a complex patchwork of many quotations and gear shifts. And it's an experience of passionate thinking and difficult thinking. It enacts that in this very witty and yet also painful and knowing way.
McLean's essay starts out as a straight-ahead critical commentary, but its experimentalism comes in when she begins to obliquely relate some of the difficulties that she personally was having on the question of marriage. And we asked her to tell us a little bit more about that.
I was about to get married, but felt extremely ambivalent about it and couldn't figure out how to manage that ambivalence and whether that ambivalence was in fact a prompting to defer a wedding, to end a relationship, to, as Rilke says, you know, change my life. And I was really in the veil of unknowing, and I could not feel my way through that.
McLean did go through with the wedding and through a tense marriage, then through an affair and a divorce.
And she used Marianne Moore's poem, she says, as an occasion for thinking through that duress, a sort of hybrid way of thinking. Her essay becomes an emotional meditation on marriage, with heavy quotation from Moore's poem Marriage, as well as many other poems by Moore.
And it's part of the way I think. It's part of the way I think many people who are very immersed in poetry, or say someone's really immersed in pop music or very immersed in films, you know, your mind moves through these. Your mind is endlessly sampling. And for me, you know, the ocean of my mind is filled with waves of poetry. And so what I wanted to do was to distill that in some way to make it shareable and hopefully of interest to a reader.
Here's the last few pages of her essay. And we'll start just after she mentions that at her wedding, the Denise Levertov poem, The Ache of Marriage, was read.
We were in the arc of it, the ache of it. Though our aches were different and the arc of our covenant ultimately, necessarily, belatedly broken. Quote, this amalgamation, which can never be more than an interesting impossibility, unquote, became an excruciating impossibility. Below the incandescent stars, below the incandescent fruit, something was broken, and there was nothing to be done, and, quote, it tears one to pieces, and each fresh wave of consciousness is poison, unquote. When but to think was to be full of sorrow. When to be conscious was to wish to be dead. When in some moods one had to admit, quote, I am such a cow. If I had a sorrow, I should feel it a long time. I am not one of those who have a great sorrow in the morning and a great joy at noon, unquote. There was this other prior thing of thinking sorrow, this wonderful keening and sometimes ludic thing. In the midst of all rending and beyond all unknowing, there is a gratitude for those who survey what's impossible, for those who say that, quote, love is the only fortress strong enough to trust to, unquote. Those who cry out saying, quote, if that which is at all were not forever, why would those who graced the spires with animals and gathered there to rest on cold, luxurious, low stone seats, a monk and monk and monk, between the thus ingenious roof supports, have slaved to confuse grace with a kindly manner, time in which to pay a debt, the cure for sins, a graceful use of what are yet approved stone mullions branching out across the perpendiculars, unquote. A gratitude for those who wonder, if that which is at all were not forever, how to persist, quote, what is our innocence, what is our guilt? All are naked, none is safe, unquote. All honor to those who wave the pure flag of a difficult joy. Quote, so he who strongly feels, behaves. The very bird, grown taller as he sings, steals his form straight up. Though he is captive, his mighty singing says, satisfaction is a lowly thing. How pure a thing is joy! This is mortality, this is eternity.
This is beautiful, what she reads here, but you can't quite manage to give a sense of the surprise of this essay and how it turns so abruptly from literary criticism into personal revelation and the effect that that has upon what she's reading. And there's a very sharp, poignant, painful part of this essay when she starts talking about herself, and you realize just how much it has mattered to her that she be able to read all of this Marianne Moore, how much the work has mattered to her and how thoroughly she's lived it. That's sort of the first thing. The second thing, I can't believe she read The Ache of Marriage at her wedding by Denise Levertov. Can you?
Freudian slip.
Right. It is Leviathan and we in its belly looking for joy, some joy not to be known outside it, two by two in the arc of the ache of it. The famous poem about the very ambivalent state of marriage. So.
It's like a, you know, Lowell, the woe that is in marriage.
To speak of woe that is in marriage. Exactly,
that's
yeah.
What this whole essay is about. But, you know, it does a very useful thing, and it's rare, really. But she rescues a poem from obscurity. I remember when I first came across Marriage. I thought it was a wild poem, and no one ever talks about it. It's really true. It's very weird. It's very long. It isn't at all what we think of as Marianne Moore, but I'll tell you, I would never have known what to say about it. I just thought it was one of those strange things in Marianne Moore's cabinet of curiosities.
Yeah, and she really picks it apart and shows us how it's put together, and also, and I think this is unusual for criticism about Moore, also how much emotion is invested in the lines, how much pent-up feeling is there for Marianne Moore.
It's really beautiful that she does that, because, you know, a lot of the sort of knock on Marianne Moore is that she's dispassionate or scientific or something like that. But it's not true, and it seems like Maureen has really gravitated to the lines that, as you would want from any fine poem, the lines that can mean the most to you in a moment of duress. She just gathers them together here so that although she's focused on that Marianne Moore poem, Marriage, she connects it with other poems that we're more familiar with, anthology pieces like What Are Years, and they connect beautifully. But yeah. I mean, that's in this case as much Maureen MacLean's skill as Marianne Moore's. I mean, you know, these things sort of awaited excavation or explanation, and now they just seem so clear and inevitable.
Yeah, I really think that this is the direction that criticism is moving in, and the best criticism is moving in, is that it, and it's not new. I mean, Susan Howe did it with My Emily Dickinson, which is clearly being referenced by My Marianne Moore 30 years ago, and this ability to read with all the skill of a literary scholar and yet with the empathy of a person, you know, whose life is being affected by these lines and who's living their lives while they're having these insights. And that's, you know, we read her whole book when we were getting ready to publish this excerpt. And we should say we only have an excerpt from a much longer piece on Marianne Moore in her book. And she does this throughout her book with a lot of different poets. I think listeners really want to seek out the book to see somebody who's doing criticism in a very different way, something that there aren't a lot of precedents for it. You can read Maureen MacLean's essay and everything else you heard on this program in the May 2012 issue of Poetry Magazine and online at poetrymagazine.org.
Let us know what you thought of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org.
The Poetry Magazine podcast is recorded by Ed Herman and produced by Curtis Fox Productions.
The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. I'm Don Scher.
And I'm Christian Wyman. Thanks for listening.